Have you ever, like, as a person, do you ever just, like, stumble? Like, you just can't...
No, I don't understand what you're talking about.
Like, you can't start the engine. You just can't get things going.
Yeah. Like basically every day.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty motivated, and I have things relatively organized, and I get things going. But then, like, the last... I don't know. It was, like, the last month between... And I just came back from vacation, too, so I should be all charged up. I don't want to get back into it. Maybe that's it. Right?
Well, I mean, it just throws you off. Something about going on vacation.
Yeah, you go away for a week. And I was away for a week, and I got my podcast out to the people of the world. And I didn't...
To the people.
And I didn't... I was home for the last 2 weeks, and I didn't publish my podcast yesterday. So I'm going to try to get this one out by Sunday. But today's guest, meaning yesterday's, meaning... I don't even know. We're just traveling through future and past all in one. This is like the fourth dimension coming into fruition. So the podcast for which you are listening to right now is kind of a cool story. It's this guy I know named Ron Fazio, and we've known him for years. And we'll kind of tell the story. He's a fellow PA, and he's in surgery and all that. So don't turn off the phone yet. I mean, don't turn off your podcast yet, okay? It's not going to be boring talk about PA school. What happened is this guy actually has a really cool prior life back in the 80s. He's about a decade ahead of me on everything, like school and college and all that. And back in the 80s, he just had some fun things happen to him involving getting tackled by Too Tall Jones, former NFL player for the NFL Cowboys. There's a little hint. NFL. What? Dallas Cowboys. See, I can't. My brain's just not working. You know what I need? I need some alpha brain.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
I don't even know if I brought home some alpha brain. I could use some, apparently. Yeah, I've had a virus for like a month ago. I had a virus, and then the last maybe 3 or 4 days I've had one. And you're like, great, don't worry, I cleaned up in here. But I just can't get. I feel like I'm in a cloud somewhere. So
is it Zika?
Where were you traveling? It could be. We were in Charleston, but it's very tropical Charleston. There's not Charleston, Myrtle Beach. See, I don't even know where I was. The hell is wrong with me? So anyways, this episode is Ron Fazio, and it should be brought to you by Onnit. So if you ever feel like me right now, take some nootropics.
I pronounce it nootropic.
Take some nootropics. Nootropics. N-O-O-T-R-O-P-I-C-S.
Actually, tropic is probably better.
Tropics. This one's called Alpha Brain. You take it, it's supposed to make your head work. And you know what? It would have been a great ad had I taken some, but I didn't. It's actually at work, to be honest with you. It's sitting at my desk at work, because at work I have to use my brain all the time. So yeah, this week's show is about Ron Fazio and his trip to a brief career in the NFL, and then he went and played a character in a B-level, or what's that called, B horror movie. So, the, you know, the B movies, they just churned them out back in the 80s.
Yeah.
But it's funny. He ended up being, and I didn't know this. I knew the guy for like a decade before I was watching. It was to let the cat out of the bag, I guess, give it away. I was watching The Toxic Avenger, and all of a sudden I see starring Ron Fazio. And I'm like, what? Can't be. It's got to be the same name. So then I IMDb him, and sure enough, there he is.
That's crazy.
I know. So I joke, I tell Maddie, because when Maddie was born, they sent a gift, like a little blanket. And I'm like, Maddie, that's a very special blanket. The Toxic Avenger gave you that blanket. So without further ado, here's the podcast with Ron Fazio. Enjoy.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
One of the common things we talk about on this program is how quickly the last 5 years, maybe even say the last decade, technology has been advancing.
Yeah.
It used to be, hey, look, an iPod. And then, you know, you'd have that for a few years. And, hey, look, an iPhone. But now it's like every month you turn on the TV and there's something new that's just grabbing people, the latest being the Pokemon Go and stuff. And and medicine is right along there. You know, you're hearing about nanotechnology and immunotherapies, things that are targeting very specific physiology in the body by hijacking other ways the body works. So are you seeing any of this in CT?
Well, yeah. I mean, just since I've been involved with it, I started in cardiothoracic surgery in, 1990-something.
Okay.
99, 98. But and back then, I mean, for what we do, you know, we have to, you know, find a conduit, which would be, you know, for the bypass surgery for some of these patients who have blockages in their hearts. So the conduit that's mainly used is the saphenous vein in the legs.
Mm-hmm.
And the saphenous vein sort of goes up basically from the ankle all the way up the inner leg, all the way up to the groin. So back in those days when it first started, we were opening up the whole leg. So as a PA, it was kind of, you know, exciting for us to be able to do the surgery, you know, part of the surgery. Instead, you're not just assisting, you're actually doing part of the surgery. So we had to learn how to actually take out this vein, and sometimes you needed a whole leg of vein to do, you know, four or five bypasses. So we were opening up the whole leg. Now, you know, through, like you say, technology, they've come up with minimally invasive techniques where you can make a very small hole at the knee area and kind of using a scope, go up the thigh or down the calf and take the vein out that way. So you're using a scope to get all the way up into a tunnel. You're freeing up the vein, ligating it where you need to ligate it, and taking off the branches where you need to do that. And you can get this vein out with very minimal holes in the leg. So you might have a little stab up in the groin. You have maybe a little inch incision at your knee. And maybe if you need to go down the leg, you have like a little stab incision down the leg. So that's, in a nutshell, you know, where vein harvesting is at the present day, where, you know, years ago you had to have your whole leg opened up and it was very painful. With the other technologies, in fact, I'm probably not even up to date with everything because, you know, with your hospital, they can only do so much with what you have. But we've already seen surgeries that come by for symptomatic atrial fibrillation. You could have a surgery which is minimally invasive. It's called a convergent ablation surgery, where you can have an instrument inserted into your abdomen, goes through the diaphragm, and goes to the back of the heart. And it could actually burn some of the tissue in the back of the heart. And that's a lot of times where some of the Purkinje fibers are back there, where they, you know, have the conduction for the heart, and when it gets a little bit disrupted, it can, you know, cause atrial fibrillation. And by doing this procedure, you can actually knock out the atrial fibrillation. So it's very amazing.
Do you realize how much you're depressing me right now? let me tell you about. Okay, listen. So now the listeners heard that. Let me tell you. I have a piece of plastic that I stick up people's noses to see the color of their mucus. Well, the good thing about it is
important. That's really important.
Yeah, you know what I spend the majority of my day doing? Telling people they don't need a Z-Pack.
Right.
I can't. It's like the bane of my existence. I go in and I take a deep breath at the door. Sometimes I would rather go in and say you need a heart transplant, because that's easier. I can just tell you what you need instead of going in there and saying, okay, you have a virus.
Well, I hear you. That's what makes it an art. I mean, you know, for us, it's all science, but for you, it's an art. You have to be able to distinguish what is wrong, what is not wrong, and how do you deal with it. In a way, I just feel like, yeah, that's why I do like what I do, because it's sort of hands-on. You know what's wrong, you go to fix it, and then, God willing, they get better. I mean, 99.something% of our patients do get better, but there's always the kind of that don't do so well. And that's going to happen with any types of surgery. But you know, it's almost like they come in, they have a problem, you fix it, they get better, they go home. Mm-hmm. And whereas you're dealing with a lot of the stuff that's, it's not so cut and dry. It's not so, we're not sure. We got to make sure that this is not this and not that. And you got to make sure you treat it in the right way. So it's an art.
You're right. You made me feel a little bit better about myself there.
You have to. You know, we got to stick together. We're PAs. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a previous life.
Yeah, that's right. So that's what we're gonna get into. So
you said we're gonna go way back.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things I want to ask, and I'm trying to figure out how we're gonna start this. So I think one of the funnier things about you, Ron, is I met you as a PA, and right. I think I knew you for a number of years as a PA. Actually, you know what? I want to say it was only a couple years ago that I figured out this hidden life that you had. And the first part of that hidden life, Either this is a false memory and Kara told me this story, or this actually happened. Maybe it happened with Kara, but to put it down, we were visiting your house, and mm-hmm. I believe Emma, your daughter, came down wearing a mm-hmm. either an Eagles shirt or a Cowboys shirt.
Right.
And I want to say it was Eagles because that's all the information I could pick up here, but I think, well, we'll get into that. And I said, okay. I said, oh, so you're an Eagles fan. And she said, no, it's my dad's shirt. And I said, mm-hmm. oh my goodness, you know, you're an Eagles fan? I thought you were from, where are you from? You're a New Yorker, right?
Well, yeah. Well, sort of. I grew up in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
And then in my adult life, I guess I moved up to New York and that's where I met Dana. But yeah, I was... South Jersey boy. So we were in where I grew up was a town called Willingboro, and it was a suburb of Philadelphia. Jersey is a small state, so the northern part of New Jersey is New York suburb. They get New York stations, and so the southern part of New Jersey is Philadelphia.
Okay, so you were then an Eagles fan.
Well, yeah, growing up we were Eagles, Flyers, Phillies, yeah.
Okay. So she told me that and then I said, oh, so you're an Eagles fan, and then you said, no, I used to play for the Eagles.
We used to play for the Eagles.
And right. I think I said, wait, no, are you serious? So and I guess it's not that big of a surprise. I mean, you're not a small guy. What are you, about 6'3", 6'4"?
Yeah, just about.
Yeah. So, I mean, it that part doesn't come as a surprise, but the fact that, I mean, it's not like you go to your house and there's, you know, football jerseys everywhere like that, or, you know, it just didn't.
Right. I definitely keep it under wraps.
Yeah. So let's start with then. So obviously we let the cat out of the bag. You played professional football for the Philadelphia Eagles back in 1987. Am I right?
Well, yeah, let me even go back a little bit further.
Okay.
Only because to fill in the gap, I graduated from University of Maryland, the Terrapins, mm-hmm. in 1984. This is to fill in a gap there here. I played football there. We went to a few bowl games. I wasn't any great shakes. I thought it was decent. No, you know, nothing really terrific, but I did get a chance to play with Boomer Esiason and Frank Reich, you know, very famous, great quarterbacks from University of Maryland. So the spring of 1985, I'm done playing college football, and I didn't know what the heck I'm gonna do. So I was just sort of, you know, hanging out with my parents. I was living with my parents at the time. It was in South Jersey, working out, going to the gym, and I get a call. I forget what day it was, sometime in the spring, but I get a call from Gil Brandt's office in the Dallas Cowboys.
Okay.
And I'm going, who is this? This is a joke. Who? One of my friends. It's got to be one of my friends calling me and saying, no, you know. Well, it turned out it wasn't a joke. They actually wanted to have me in their training camp for, you know, offer me a position. Not drafted. I didn't get drafted. But they said, we'd like to have you try out with the Dallas Cowboys.
Okay.
So this was 1985. And I said, listen, I don't know. I think this is a joke, but if you send me the tickets, I'll be there. Send me the airplane tickets, I'll be there. So, of course, I get the airplane tickets in the mail, and they have a training camp down in Dallas.
So wait, let's pause for a second. You had been out of college for how long at this point?
No, I had just graduated
college. Oh, you just graduated. Okay.
So I graduated college. I actually took an extra semester. I graduated in December of 1984.
Okay.
So in the spring of 1985,
okay,
brings us to right there. I mean, we were just right out of college.
Were you in any shape at this time?
I was keeping in shape. Yeah. I just figured, what the heck? I'm just going to work out and maybe there'll be a chance. I'm not sure. If there is, I'll take it. If not, you know, I won't take it. But
what's going through your head at this point? When, I mean, so you gotta look at it this way, right? So I'm 5'9", right? I'm the average American, or I think 5'10", 5'9", 5'10", whatever that is, the average, but I fit right. that area. I wrestled, okay. You know, I wasn't going to become a professional wrestler. Right. You know, every kid wants to dream about being a pro athlete. You get the call. What goes through your mind? Is it, I mean, obviously you thought it was a joke maybe.
Well, yeah, first I thought it was a joke, but, you know what? The phone is ringing and the girls are at it. I'm not even going to answer it. So I just want to keep that over there. Okay. You'll hear it down in the background. Okay. So I'm thinking, holy crap, this might be a chance. I mean, what the heck? I mean, I was kind of floored thinking that, you know, am I good enough to do this? I don't know. I mean, you know, second guessing. And, you know, there was times in college where I wasn't really that great. I dropped a few passes here and there and, now I'm going to have to either put up or shut up here if I get a chance to do this. So I was scared out of my shorts.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean,
you know, I wanted the chance. You know, don't get me wrong. I wanted the chance. I mean, I played college football, you know, all the way back, you know, from Little League to high school to college. And I'm thinking, maybe I'll take it as far as I could take it. So that's what happened. So they send me the tickets and I, you know, I'm thinking, I'm going to go after this as much as I can. So I just, that's what I tried to do. Get myself into really good shape. And, you know, I go into this Dallas little training camp and it was just the rookies. It was just some of the guys who I'd heard of all over the country. So, you know, they had, I think I was a tight end at the time, you know, in my career, I was a tight end, and they had brought in a few tight ends from different colleges who I'd heard of. And, you know, you kind of, you know, are friends with them because they're, you know, they're in the same boat, only at a different college.
Yeah.
And it was just a neat little camaraderie, but it was very intimidating to see some of these incredible athletes that you're trying to compete with. And I'm thinking, can I be on the same field with these guys? Now, this wasn't even the real pro guys. That's a whole nother story. But, you know, these guys were just really, you know, pretty good athletes from college, all trying to make it just like I was. So We went through this spring training. I don't think I was, you know, that impressive. I think there was, a couple other guys that were, you know, pretty impressive. But I just figured this summer I better get myself into some better shape, you know.
Yeah.
So I took that time after this little mini camp that I went to in the spring. I said I knew I had to report, you know, in 1985. I was going to have to report, I guess, in end of July to their real training camp. And that's what I did. I spent the whole summer working out, trying to get stronger, trying to get faster, trying to get in shape. And also being a tight end, I called the local high school to see if I can get a quarterback to, you know, throw me some passes every day so I can kind of get your catching skills down, because I was never known as a pass receiver. But
okay,
that's beside the point. But anyway, I got myself into shape and then, you know, went to training camp in the fall. Well, July is not the fall, but late summer of 85 was with the Dallas Cowboys.
Did you have to do some sort of combine or anything like that? Did they have that in those days?
They did, but I was not invited. I was not a superstar candidate in college. So
okay.
It would have been great, but I wasn't invited. And now they really depend on those things. So I think they're a lot more evident that, you know, today than they were back in 1984 and 85.
Did someone just see film from Brandt's office, or how did they get?
Yeah, that's about it. They have recruiting and guys all over the country. They say, hey, yeah, this guy's, you know, potentially good. And I'm sure they had, you know, coaches contacting, you know, said, hey, yeah, try this guy. And, you know, I'm sure that you get a positive nod from a coach here and there, and that helps the decision. But what I do feel is that the pro teams will ask a lot of players to come and be on the team as a temporary thing until, if you make it, yeah, you get a signed contract. But
right. All
the while you're there, you're on the cutting block. You don't know if you're going to make it. So it's a tryout after tryout after tryout. Every day you have to perform. And, you know, they're filming you every day, so you better perform or else they're going to have proof that you're not performing, and they give you the cut, they give you the axe. So it's not like you've achieved something. You have to achieve it every day.
Yeah.
You know, unless you have like some no cut contract, or if you're a big name superstar where, you know, they're going to keep you no matter what. You know, some of these guys sign like 4-year contracts, but for, you know, a no name rookie like myself, it was just a 1-year deal. And if you make it, they'll get you another contract next year. And, you know, things like that. They really make it so that, you know, if you're always on the chopping block. So.
And it's not, I guess today you still see that, you know, you'll see a team that picks up someone, and you're like, who's this guy? And then they play, you know, they, and sometimes it works out great. Look at, and I can't believe I'm embarrassed right now, 'cause I'm a Patriots fan. I can't think of the name of the kid that, ran the block at the, end zone, for the Super Bowl.
Gronkowski?
No, he ran the block.
I don't know.
Whatever it was. It came down to a no-name guy that just happened to, it was an end zone play. They were at the 1-yard line, and, he tried to run it, and this kid just came up out of nowhere and tackled it.
Oh, yeah.
Caused a turnover. Yeah. And we're where was this? And yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. That's, I think that was kind of the same situation. I mean, that he's just like one of those guys, special teams, specialized, I guess, obviously that's why they have it special teams, but specialized in a position, and then big things can happen. So,
yeah. Well, the next exciting part was when you actually do report to the camp, and now you're looking at you're on the same field with guys like Tony Dorsett, Randy White, Ed Too Tall Jones, Danny White, Robert Newsom.
That's incredible.
Dub Cosby, you know, some of these guys were just superstars from my high school days. I mean, I was a big football fan growing up, and I mean, you watch these guys on TV, and now you're on the same field with them.
Yeah.
And we want to talk about intimidating. Oh my Lord. You know, it was just incredible. I mean, I'm sitting here across the line. I mean, a couple times, you know, you have to go against these guys because they'll run a scout team against the first team defense, and now I got to hit. I actually have to hit Ed Too Tall Jones, or I actually have to hit Randy White. That was kind of cool because Randy White did go to Maryland, and I was from Maryland too. So, but oh my gosh, when I tell you, it steps up a level when you get to the pros.
Yeah,
I've never been hit so hard by some of these guys. Now, Ed Too Tall Jones was one of the guys who I thought he was, you know, huge.
Yeah.
But when you try to hit this guy, it's like a brick wall. It's like a brick wall.
What are these big stars like when you're on the, I mean, at this point, it's just a day at the office for them. And
a day at the office. They've been there for how many years now, already done it, and they don't want anybody messing with their stuff. So,
yeah.
But they were very cool, very classy bunch of guys. But, you know, like I was going to make the point, like hitting Ed Too Tall Jones is like hitting a brick wall. But hitting Randy White was like hitting a brick wall that hit back. And I saw stars like quite a few times. Now, you know, I have no idea what that did to my brain, but I mean, I saw some stars.
Yeah. And that and this was day in and day out, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And again, you had to be able to be ready for that. And you know, in today's day, they really do have some good protection for concussions, but I have never been diagnosed with a concussion. I hope I never have been, but we'll see. We'll see how I age.
That's fine. Yeah. 'Cause in 85, I mean, people were still wearing like, the single, bar mask or bar, you know what they're called, whatever the face guards there. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
I mean, I had good protection there, and I mean, I feel like I wasn't at risk. So I feel like I still have my faculties, but there's a few issues that I wonder about.
Yeah.
But one day in practice, though, I broke my thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, things were going really well. For some reason, I mean, you know, I had gotten myself into good shape, and it had now been, I don't know, a couple games into the season. We had just gotten done. We played a preseason game against the San Diego Chargers. We flew to San Diego, and it was very – I mean, I didn't play that much, but when I got in there, I thought I did pretty well, and I caught two passes from Danny White. I was very happy. I was like, this is going good. I caught two passes, you know. And yeah. I think we won the game. I mean, it wasn't, you know, anything – it's this preseason game. The very next day in practice, we're playing, I don't know, in a scrimmage or whatever. We're doing full contact and everything, and then something happened, and my thumb got caught, bent the wrong way, and it actually broke. So during the practice, I'm thinking, all right, must have sprained it. I don't know. Tape it up. It'll be okay. Made it through the whole practice and really kind of ignored it, but it was painful.
Yeah.
Swelled up a lot that night, so I had to go see the doctor the next day, and he said, yeah, we got to get x-rays for this. And he saw the fracture in the little lower base of my thumb, so now I couldn't do anything. I was now considered injured, on injured reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I mean, they looked at it. They had a couple of doctors look at it. It didn't need surgery. Originally, they thought it might need surgery because it might have been displaced a little bit, but it was sort of, I don't know, back into place, and I just, you know, had it casted. And so now here I am. You know, I thought I was doing pretty well at the time. Now I'm hurt. I can't do anything because, you know, being a tight end, you can't even play because you got a hand in a cast and you can't catch the ball. So now I'm out for, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks, and it was just a heartbreak for me because I thought that things were going well.
Yeah, it's got to be. I can't even imagine.
And after the whole time comes when, you know, now you got the cast off and you're doing some rehab on your thumb and you got the motion back on it, and now things, okay, get back into practice. And that was, I guess, there was some sort of cutoff line in the area of, I don't know, around November where, you know, you have to kind of make some decisions. Well, I was let go because when I came back, now, you know, you haven't been catching the football for about 6 weeks. You kind of lose some of that hand-eye coordination, and I just couldn't get it really back right away. I had, you know, I was probably going to have to work on it for a few more weeks before it really came back to me. Tom Landry got a hold of me and said, "Well, we're going to let you go." So, I tried to beg and plead. I was down on my knees. No, only kidding.
hey, at least he got let go by Tom Landry. I mean, if you're
going to... Yeah, it was... he was a class guy. I really, you know, it was just... he was just a class guy. And then the whole organization, all the players, that once you showed them that you understood and you knew how to play the game... you know, you got respect from, you know, the defensive players, the offensive players. It was very nice. You know, I felt like part of the team. They made you feel part of the team. They were a class organization. And Tom Landry also treated me, you know, very much like a part of the team. However, he said, "We're going to have to let you go." So
yeah,
I don't know how far you take that. Part of the team, but, you know, you can't stay here.
He's done it a few times.
But he was very, very nice about it. Very, that's good. You know, very humble. And I told him it was a great experience. And the best thing I did was before I left, because I kind of could see the writing on the wall, possibly. I couldn't tell if I was going to make it or not. But there was a little yearbook that they had, and I bought. It was called The 50 Years of the Dallas Cowboys, and I got everybody to autograph it. So now I have old 1985 Cowboys autographs in this in my book.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it's a good collector's item.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that was my experience in Dallas. So I decided, well, you know, I had bought a car. Luckily, I didn't buy an expensive car. Some of these guys were buying the Mercedes. So I took the car, you know, drove it back up to New Jersey. And that's, you know, basically where I tried to see, well, maybe I could do this again. I don't know. It worked out okay there. Maybe I could do it again. So I started putting the feelers out for Philadelphia. And luckily, through connections, I did get a chance to go. And I mean, like the next year, because now this is, you know, winter, I guess it's close to winter in 85. So in 86 of the spring, I was just driving across the river from New Jersey to Philadelphia, working out with some of the Philadelphia Eagles. Randall Cunningham was there. Ron Jaworski was there. And Reggie White was there at the time too.
Oh, wow.
Big old Reggie White, but he was on the defense. So I was working out with the offense, and it was nice. You know, you sort of felt like, you know, I'm no longer a rookie, even though it's my first time on the team. You're not really a rookie. So they kind of treated you with some respect and throwing you the passes and going on, you know, the routes that you need to work on. And it was a really nice, you know, feeling to be a part of the team. Well, the unfortunate part of the whole equation was Buddy Ryan was now the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. And in a nutshell, let's just say he was a mean, nasty guy.
Really?
And it was pretty harsh to try to make an impression.
Yeah.
On a guy that was so seasoned and so, you know, very strict on what he wanted. And if you didn't measure up, you know, you were out. So I tried out with the Philadelphia Eagles in 1986, and I stayed for pretty much most of the preseason. But, you know, you could kind of see that he was not too thrilled with my performance. Now, again, I was pretty, you know, pretty decent. I wasn't, you know, a lot of guys would say, hey, doing a good job, doing a good job. However, there was one situation, and we had just gotten done. Ironically, the Philadelphia Eagles had a preseason game against the San Diego Chargers, almost just like last year. I had a preseason game against the San Diego Chargers when I was on the Dallas Cowboys. So I get put on the kickoff team. And the problem was, you know, on the kickoff team, you got to have these a lot of, you know, fast guys on there. So I ran okay. I was ran like a 4.8, 4.9, 40 yard dash. However, when you compare that to some of these guys running 4.5s and 4.4s, you really look slow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on the films, when you see the films, you could see that, okay, there's these guys about 10 yards ahead of me, and there's me about 10 yards behind.
Yeah.
And we're sitting in the film room. The whole team's in there, and here's Buddy Ryan going, "Wait a minute!" And he had a mouth on him, so I'm not going to repeat that. But he was just, "Who the f is number number three in from the side? Who the f is number three from the side?" And one of the coaches looks up and says, "That's Ron Fazio." And he's like, "Get him the f out of there!" So I knew I was done the next day, and wouldn't you know it, you know, they just said they cleared out your locker, and he was not a class guy. He didn't come and see you, or you didn't come and see his office and say, "We're going to let you go," like Tom Landry did. You just knew you were gone because your locker was empty. It was just your t-shirt and your socks and your jock strap and everything that you owned, and all the stuff that they owned was taken. So
that's got to be that brutality. I mean, it has to come with the fact that you're dealing with, I mean, I guess the pool of talent isn't that big, but if you consider all the colleges out there and all the people that are fighting for those positions, that they can just do that because they know someone's going to be there to fill it. And,
right.
And when you're talking 5/10 of a second, it's the difference between staying and going. I mean, that's brutal.
That's exactly it, and that is true. And like you say, the you know, to get into that level, of course, there's not a lot of guys who could do that. So again, I kind of feel proud about the fact that I made it to there. But when you get up there, that it just exceeds your expectations. That, oh my gosh, these guys, number one, they're fast as anything. Number two, they're strong as anything. And number three, they hit you so hard, and it's like, oh my gosh, what the hell was that? So the talent at that level, I mean, we see it on TV and it almost looks like they make it look easy. Same thing with like acting, and I'll get into that later.
Yeah.
But you know, they make it look easy.
Yeah.
But it's so high octane talent that, you know, it's just incredible to be a part of it and then go, "Oh my gosh, I don't think I'm measuring up here." And I obviously, you know, at the time, I think I could have made it. However, with the standards that, you know, were held by Buddy Ryan, I was not going to be making it. And I think it's also a numbers game, too, because at that point in time, they really couldn't keep like five tight ends or four tight ends. They can only keep like two tight ends. And then what they do is they fill in if they needed another tight end, they'd put a lineman over there, you know, so that they wouldn't have to use another tight end to wait, you know, to take up a position on the team. I'm not sure how it is now, but there was a number restriction back then. So,
and I think the positions were more universal back then. You know, I want to say back in the 90s, I don't know, or late 90s, I don't know if Tom Tupa's even still playing, but he was one of the few remaining quarterback punters, you know? I mean, even that was, now it's so specialized, I don't know if there's any of them out there anymore.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, there's every once in a while you're going to get a guy like Bo Jackson or somebody who could do sports, but to get really good at what you're doing at that level, I think you really need to be a one position type of person. Oh, so you can concentrate on that and be the best at that position. So, I mean, I play the same position as, you know, what Gronkowski plays today on, mm-hmm. you know, Patriots. I mean, that guy is amazing. I feel like his talent is, I could never compare to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I tried.
Yeah.
But, you know, to see how he performs, how fast he is, how big he is, and how easily he catches the ball, I always struggled with all those things. Mm. And to see that type of talent, I know that this guy is good. And I'm sure there's a lot of other ones, but that one's that just comes to my mind right now. Cause
oh yeah, Gronk's.
I'm not exactly a fan of the Patriots, so I don't, you know, but I like them. I think that they're a great team. So, I mean.
I bleed Patriots. I mean, I grew up there. I have to. And I saw the whole Drew Bledsoe go down, Tom Brady, a no name, come out of nowhere and lead him to the Super Bowl in 2001. So I'm,
for how many years? Yeah. That's been a long time.
Yeah. It was 2001. Yeah. 15 years.
Right.
Brought him there five. No, more than that.
I did the
math. They've been in like, every other, like, if you do the math, it's every third Super Bowl they've been in since like 96. Like they've been in a third of all the Super Bowls. They're just, and then the playoffs, it's something like they've been number one, or at least they've won the title. I can't remember how many times, something like 8 out of 10 times. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yep. And they're a dynasty. They are a dynasty. Yeah.
And I'm wondering too, because we touched on technology at the beginning of this. I wonder too, with athletes today and their ability to like analyze their movements down to the, I mean, you ever see them put on these suits and they can videotape them and then watch their movements and see where they're, you know, okay, your step on the left is just a little bit too slow. Try turning it, the level that they're analyzing these guys, even with like baseball and their swing and the pitches and,
Yeah, that technology is there, and I think that it is utilized. I have no idea how it is utilized sometimes, but I think with the defenders, you know, how they make, you know, cover a guy making a, you know, strong cut to mm-hmm. the inside, or what you're going to do, or how you're going to react. You know, they want to make sure that you react on a certain level, and a lot of times it's like milliseconds that you, like, say a defender has to react, but yet a receiver has to know how to, you know, get that guy turned around so that maybe he can get a chance to catch the ball. So you're working on a lot of different things, and the technology on a computer could possibly help you with that. So I don't know, but I think it is being used.
Yeah, it's gotta be. I mean, we went
and then I know the technology of the helmets have changed too, because of the injuries, and you know, there's a lot more padding these days, and there's a lot more, I mean, I guess the helmets are actually bigger to protect the head a lot better. So, you know, I think that it's become better, but however, these guys have become more violent too, in a sense that these guys hit hard.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm surprised more people don't go down and stay down. A lot of them get up because they got their bell rung or whatever, but man, it's not a fun thing to be the receiver of a hit like some of these guys are hitting.
Yeah, the only way I can relate is like I said, I was a wrestler, and then I went into in the military. I did a lot of martial arts, and then stuck with jiu-jitsu up until, gosh, maybe 35. Not much beyond that, because I got my spine's a mess, so I can't do it anymore. I mean, I was smart enough to say, you know, I'm not making money doing this, so there's no reason to do it. But every now and then, the gyms that I worked out in, I'd get in and spar with the pros. And yeah, you're right. There's this way that when you get hit, how I describe it is, and this is, I'm wearing a brain bucket, we call it. I would be wearing a headgear, and
yeah,
they would hit so hard that I would see my retina. Like, you could see the blood supply just like spider web across your eyeballs. Yeah. So that would be the first thing. And then the second thing that getting hit really hard is, literally, it felt like the mat or the whatever you call it, the where you box the whatever, came up and whacked me on the side of the head. You know, instead of me going down, I was like, why is the floor all of a sudden next to me? And then it took me a second to be like, oh, okay. And that's when, and that's also when I was in PA school and stuff. And I was like, you know, this is probably not a good idea. I need this brain to to do work.
Yeah, I'm sure your audience won't know the coup and contra coup.
Oh yeah,
to the brain inside of the skull. So
that's right. Yeah,
that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And it could be a problem. I saw the movie Concussion. You should go see it.
Did you? So yeah, I was going to ask you, if you had a son, would you encourage football, or is it one of those things you'd say, let's stay away from it?
Wow, that's a very good question, and I think I would be on the fence. Especially with, you know, Little League and high school, I'm not sure they're doing that severe hitting that they do up in the college and pros.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. I think I would be open to it. However, I wouldn't, you know, encourage them. Oh, you got to play football. I think golf is great. I think tennis is great. But, you know, I happen to be, my brother and I grew up playing it. My dad was a big football fan. We were all, you know, kind of big. My brother was 6'3". I'm 6'3", or 6'4", I forget. But I think because we were big, that's why we played it.
Yeah.
And then as you play it, you get better at it. And if, you know, well, we did get better at it as you go through Little League and high school. And I think that's what, I guess, became a motivating factor, because my brother did get a scholarship to Notre Dame. And then first I got a scholarship to University of Maryland, and then he got a scholarship to Notre Dame. And I feel like, wow, we helped our parents pay for college here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't encourage it, but I would be open to it. Especially at the levels of Little League and college and high school. And then you take it from there. If you're good enough, you know, sure, go ahead and play it in college, and take it, if you could take it where you, like I did. I mean, I would not shut the door just because it's a violent sport. I would just say, hey, be aware that this could happen.
See, I think it's a vast conspiracy. I think NFL, well, actually, maybe you changed my mind on that with the description of getting hit. I'm going to say NFL is like one of the last bastions of conservative entertainment, and they're taking that away from us too. So,
well, I guess, you know, you haven't lived until you got your bell rung and you see stars and you kind of go, where am I for a second? And then you're like, okay, you have to experience that to know, you know, I don't want that anymore.
Yeah. And well, I'd never considered it. You know, people always say, yeah, they hit hard and stuff, but, you really put it well, about, and then the idea of having it every play over and over and over again, day after day. I mean, I've been hit 3 or 4 times. You're talking how many times at practice times, what, six days a week?
Quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
not
rough.
Much. I mean, like I said, I feel like I'm blessed. I didn't get like huge big hits that I was really knocked out. I don't think I've ever been knocked out. I saw stars a little bit, but you know, some of these guys are taking a beating, and you know what that movie The Concussion really pointed out is that it does damage your brain, and it could cause you to have these feelings of, you know, suicidal tendencies, which have been proven that, you know, guys like Junior Seau and,
yeah,
oh, Andre Waters and Dave Duerson, they're no longer with us because they were experiencing, you know, problems with, I guess it's neurological problems or possibly psychological problems that, you know, in the brain getting damaged, and now you can't really handle some of reality, and they took their own lives, and it's a serious thing, and there is a big class action lawsuit in the NFL that if you have experienced some of this stuff, you will be getting a settlement. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a serious thing, but I'm glad I'm not playing football anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, yeah. it mixed blessing. And the fact that, I mean, seems to be one of those things that you now have a story and an insight that most people don't or will never have the opportunity to have or appreciate. Because now it's entertainment. You throw on the TV and there it is, you know, and you don't think about the moments in between each game and each broadcast, you know, and that's, I thought that was interesting to hear about. Yeah. Here, I want to play something for you. I don't know if you can hear this. Let me know if you can hear it. If you can't, I'm going to add it in post-production. Okay. But this I discovered, I want to say it was about 2 years ago, and then I'll explain what happened, like how I figured it out from here. So tell me if you can hear this.
Okay.
From New Jersey, he came to Louisville and single-handedly wiped out crime, corruption, and chemical waste.
The name's Avenger. The toxic Avenger.
Holy shit!
But this time, there's trouble not just in Tromaville.
Messy, messy, messy.
But also in Tokyo. And there's only one brave soul who can stop the forces of evil.
Mel, I am history.
There's only one hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength, and he's back.
Don't worry, sir. I'm the Toxic Avenger.
He's a fighter. He's a thinker.
On a toilet.
He's a lover.
Yeah, be careful that one.
Criminals kids, won't close have your a eyes. Leg to stand on. People will be dancing in the streets.
Right, that's enough. You know what? What's funny? Just watching that trailer, it makes me wonder what that like. That would not even pass muster these days. I don't think.
I know. In fact. That was from The Toxic Avenger Part 2.
Ooh, even know which part just by listening to it. It's amazing.
Uh-huh. I know that because, getting into this, I had, after playing football, I was done. I was done playing football. I didn't want to do it anymore. I had a few other tryouts that, you know, it didn't really, you know, go anywhere. So I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life now. So I actually moved up to New York with a couple of dudes, and we became, you know, bouncers in New York City somewhere. So trying to skip through this a little bit here. One day, working at a nightclub, one of the Kochek girls is saying she's going to be in a movie. I'm like, okay, fine. I'm like, it sounds interesting. I wasn't really doing anything. I had some money that I had from playing football. It wasn't really that much, but I could live on it for a while. So I asked her, and I got the address and went over to some place in Hell's Kitchen over there in, 46th Street in the west side, and went to a Troma office. That's the company, Troma.
Oh, absolutely, and, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
if you like cult horror, you know the name Troma.
Well, I had no idea. That's the thing. She said she was going to be in a movie. She gives me this address, and I'm thinking, oh, this is a Hollywood movie. This is big time. I'm gonna get a part on this movie.
Yeah.
Well, the place where I went was just disgusting.
Yeah, I imagine.
It was just nasty. Put it that way. They had a lot of old posters up, and you know, pretty smelly. Walk up. It was no elevator. I had to walk to like the fifth floor or something like that. Anyway, they see I'm 6'4", kind of big guy, and they say, well, listen, we're doing a movie called The Toxic Avenger, and we were wondering if you would like to be the Toxic Avenger. And I said, wait a minute. And they said, well, wait, hold on a second. We already have a guy who's going to be the Toxic Avenger, but you would be able to do the Toxic Avenger, like the fill-in scenes or the distant shots or something like that. I said, sure, but I didn't have any acting experience. So I think that this is like a Hollywood big-time movie theater production, and I'm going, well, I don't have that much experience. And they said, well, that's okay because we don't really pay that much. I said, well, what do you mean you don't pay that much? They said, well, a lot of people work for free, and you know, some of the main actors will get paid like $50 a day, and that's about it. And I said, oh, well, that sucks, but I'll be in a movie. Okay. You don't have to twist my arm. Sure, I'll do it.
Why not, right?
Why not? I had some time on my hands. So, okay, so that's what I signed on for. I basically was, if you want to put it in terms of sports, I signed on as the second string Toxic Avenger. Because they already had a first string guy, and he was already set doing, I don't know, auditions or whatever. Rehearsals. And I was the second string guy. So got to meet a couple of guys on the set and everything. And was this
the original Toxic Avenger?
The original Toxic Avenger was done in 1985, which okay. is when I was playing football.
Okay.
So yeah, the original one was not done. So this is Toxic Avenger part two. They figured they had some success with part one. They're going to make a part two.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am. I'm in there and I'm saying, yeah, anything you got to do, I'll do it. So I was, you know, renting a room in an apartment in North Jersey, and I eventually moved into Brooklyn with a friend of mine. I became the Toxic Avenger. So, well, the second string Toxic Avenger. Now, again, long story short, through the course of filming, the first string Toxic Avenger dude thought, well, put it this way. I thought he was a star somewhere, because the way he treated everybody, the way he, you know, talked down to everybody, the way he kind of, you know, thought that he was the big cheese on the whole set, made everybody feel like, you know, garbage. And I thought, who is this guy? Is he somebody that, like, I have no idea who, I don't know, but he's some famous dude? No, nobody, everybody said no. He's just, you know, a local actor in New York, and who happens to have the main role as a Toxic Avenger. Well, he treated people like dirt. Meanwhile, I was having a great time. I was the second string Toxic Avenger, and he was a little bit intimidated by me because I was taller than him. And I thought I was better looking, but
does it matter? Does it matter when you're wearing that face?
Wearing this big, huge mask.
Yeah, yeah.
Mask. Anyway, so, but again, yeah, he started out being the Toxic Avenger. He did all the main scenes, and again, I did the second string scenes, where you a distant shot or like a fill in shot. Oh, we need something here to go here. All right. So, but over the course of the filming, he got fired. Because nobody wanted to work with him.
Sure. And
everybody said, we don't want to work with him. We want to work with Ron. Ron's great. He does everything we say. We, you know, like, because the makeup guys, you have to spend 2 hours in the chair getting the makeup put on. And I said, yeah, load it on, load it on. Meanwhile, the other guy, I don't even want to say his name, but the other guy was like saying, you know, being rude to him and saying, you know, like, stop, don't do that. And you know, not being very nice to these guys. I thought it was like Halloween every single day. I got this makeup put on me by these professional dudes who could glue it on and
yeah.
made the mask move. It was tremendous fun. So he ends up getting fired. They asked him to leave the set. So I'm going, wow, this is great. They came to me and they go, well, we got rid of the other guy, and now you're the Toxic Avenger. I said, oh, great. So now I'm going to film all of his other things that you guys already filmed. They said, no, we're just going to keep them.
Quality.
So basically, I finished the movie with them as the Toxic Avenger, and I dubbed over all the voices so that it is my voice, and it's kind of a simpleton type of voice, but that is my voice. And I didn't really make a lot more money. I just made like $50 a day.
Yeah.
But the important thing about this is that they were going to go film in Japan. So they took a small crew and me.
Oh, cool.
To Japan. And I got a free trip to Japan. We were filming there. It was a lot of fun. I learned how to speak Japanese a little bit. Plus, I knew how to say, where's the bathroom? That's what.
Plus, being a tall American over there with the film crew, they probably treated you like you were a movie star, yeah, I assume.
Yeah, I was amazed. There maybe were a few people that might have been close to 6 feet, but there were so many very tiny people there. I mean, yeah. But very polite, very nice. The experience was just tremendous. So as an ambassador to Japan, no.
Yeah.
it was a great experience. And you know, filming over there, you know, they thought, because they love their monster movies, you know, they thought I was a big, huge superstar. You know, some of the conversation was like, oh, you know Sylvester Stallone. And I said, no, I don't know Sylvester Stallone. But that's the thing, that's what they imply, that because you're making a movie, you must know all these famous American actors. And I said, no, it's not the way it works.
That's funny.
But it was a really great experience, though.
What's funny about that, or what's amazing about that is, well, I always saw your email address, which I won't say, obviously, but the very beginning of it, I just thought it was kind of strange that a PA would have this. And I think I say the first part, because the second part I don't think you'd be able to get, right?
Right, that's okay. Fine. Yeah, sure.
So the first part of your email address is toxic, and I was like, toxic, and this guy's a PA. All right, whatever. And then I was in New York, and it was,
doesn't sound very sterile, does it?
I know, exactly. I was sitting. We had just had a baby. And we were up in New York, and I remember it was just a dark, cold. We were in the tundra of New York. We were like upstate in the middle of nowhere. And I was watching, it was either on Netflix or somewhere. Maybe I found it on YouTube. And as a kid, so let's see, if this was in 87, you know, I was 10 or 11 years old. So we would get VHSs of these. And to us, this was like, you know, we were kids. We thought these were the greatest movies ever. So I'm watching them. I'm watching these old ones kind of, and then all of a sudden I see the credits, and I see Ron Fazio, and I'm like, hey, I know a guy named Ron Fazio. I can't believe. So then I Google it, and then what hit me was the toxic. Oh, no, I went to send you an email, and then I saw toxic, and I said, holy shit, this guy's Toxic Avenger. And so it was funny. I had no idea. Another thing you keep quiet.
Well, yeah, you know, it's kind of like it's been so long. I would love to, if somebody were to say, yeah, you do it again, fine. I mean, or go on a, I don't know, a little autograph signing junket or something. That'd be great. But I don't go around, you know. But a lot of people who are close to me, my colleagues, do know that I have done something like that.
Yeah. Do you get crap for it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, a little bit, but not. I mean, it's so far ago, you know, so long ago, it's not even in the conversation much anymore, but it's interesting because every once in a while it does come on TV, and I get, oh, I saw you last night on TV.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. You know, that's did you turn funny. It off because you were puking? Because it was
so that's funny.
It's really, I mean, to the audience, it's just not a great movie. It's funny. It's kind of campy. It's a B movie. So, I mean, I just got done watching Sharknado. It's in that type of realm, but it's so campy and goofy, but gross and gory. And it's got a good story. I think, you know, if they were to ever redo it, I feel like if you put it into the hands of like a mainstream character, almost like an Iron Man or that's Marvel Comics, but, you know, something where, you know, it could be done on a real mainstream type of movie. I think it would be a great thing to see the Toxic Avenger being a, I don't know, what is it, like a 90-pound weakling. He gets he gets beat up or abused in the movie or in the part one. And then he, I don't know, somehow in New Jersey, of course, New Jersey, he falls out of the window of a gym and, you know, he falls into a big open vat of toxic waste, of course, because it's in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, Love Canal, right?
And that's that you know, prompts the transformation. And then, you know, he becomes the big, huge, hulking Toxic Avenger. So now he's out to avenge evil and beat up the bad guys. So it's a great premise. And I think it would be a great mainstream type of, you know, superstar hero. But, you know, I don't think they want to do that. And if they do, I think it would be great. But
yeah.
Because I think that the trauma guys, Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz, they did do a few years, many years back, a Toxic Crusaders cartoon where Toxic Avenger was in it. And they've, you know, done a few things, but nothing really mainstream. They keep it to be like the B movie types or the low budget where they don't get into the mainstream a little bit.
There's a couple interesting things about that. Number one is so the campy movies that are made today are a tribute to the campy movies that, so they're made on purpose, that they're purposely made campy because of what was made back then, I guess on purpose too, but it wasn't, you know what I mean? They are sort of paying homage to what your directors thought was legitimate movie. You know what I mean? So, right. So like they made your movie, and today with these campy things, they're paying homage to those. So that's kind of neat. You were there. The second part about that is I think you would still do well if you went to like a Comic-Con, which is, where they have, so a Comic-Con, and I've never been to one, but I see them on the news.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. I wish I had some sort of agent that would.
That would get you there.
Because, you know, for me to sit there and do it, I don't have the time or the space or the money to do it. But you know, then you have to have. I don't know. It's not my property. I would love to be able to get the old photos so that you could sign an autograph. I do have a few, but I don't have a lot to sit there and be able to possibly sign an autograph for, I don't know, a dollar.
Yeah. Well,
I need to make some.
I'm trying to do a video aspect to this podcast. That's where I'm trying to grow to. And maybe at some point we'll take a video camera and bring you to a Comic-Con and see what we can do.
There you go. If there's one in Raleigh, I was always looking for that. I don't know if there's one in Raleigh, but the thing is, I don't know. We actually went to a couple up in New York after the filming. Uh-oh, what was that?
I don't know.
I heard a bump. Anyway, and we sat there, you know, a couple of us sat and signed autographs. And it's like, you know, you put your thing out and you get a table, and it's kind of a little bit, you know, more professional, where you just have a table, you sign autographs, and, you know, you could charge, you know, $2 for an autograph.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you like the person, you just say, here, just take this one for free. You know?
Yeah.
I wasn't there to make money, but a lot of people were. Like, I got to meet a couple of people out in Las Vegas. I got to meet Swamp Thing. That was really cool. Back in those days when he was doing his movies.
Sure, yeah.
So, and he's a big guy. But he was all, you know, we were at a, I guess, because you know what, the Toxic Avenger Part 2 got picked up as a video release by Warner Brothers. So I was at the Warner Brothers stand in this Las Vegas showroom, and it was huge. It was great. And I got to meet a couple of stars like Rich Little and Elvira. Back in the 90s, they were pretty big.
Sure.
And then his name was Dick Durock. He was the Swamp Thing. So I asked him about Heather Locklear, and he said she was a bitch.
Oh, really?
I'm only kidding.
That's funny. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
I don't have lawyers with this program. Everything's alleged. All right. Wow, those are some good stories, Ron. I didn't expect.
One more.
Yeah, absolutely.
How about one more?
Yeah.
Because I don't know how long you got to go, but.
Well, I want to before so, I like to always see how much I can relate to you. So, I was actually in a documentary about the bike ride that went across the country.
That was when we first met. You had just gotten done.
Oh, okay. So
you had just gotten done. You had a little thing at Bond Park, and Cara invited us, and it was terrific.
That's right.
I was like, it's incredible. You guys rode your bikes across the dang country.
So. Yeah.
I was very impressed.
They had a documentary crew with them, but then something legal, I don't know. I probably can't even say or something, but it never got released. So maybe it will at some point, but I have that. Mm-hmm. And then here's the other good thing. There's a movie that's going to be coming out. I'm interviewing the director. I got to look at my schedule, maybe next week or the week after that. And it's called Zombie with a Shotgun. The cool thing about this movie, and the reason why I'm having him on, is that in today's day and age, you can have someone that's creative. You can pretty much do CGI, which is computer generated, like special effects, for minimum money. The cameras are cheap, and you have an audience because there's a group of people that actually want to watch these things. So it's so amazing. Perfect. It's amazing. So that's what I'm gonna have him on the show for, to talk about.
Hey listen, you know, let him know I could be available.
Okay. do you want Toxic Avenger on? Because
yeah. You know, just for a little cameo here, maybe I get killed off or something.
That's funny. Well, I'm officially a producer, because I paid a little fee to get a poster, official poster, and a couple other things, and I get a credit now. So I am a producer of
See, now we got connections.
That's
now,
right.
Now, if you need something a few days, I can maybe get off work and.
All right, there you go. All right. So what was the next part?
The one more story that I thought was pretty good because I don't know. You guess you could call it a little bit of a spiritualness or whatever. Get a little bit of the hand of God sort of thing. Because mm-hmm. While I was trying to be an actor in New York City, I was bouncing at a nightclub. So I did start out as a bouncer. You know, I figured I'm a bigger guy. I'm not going to be a waiter because a lot of out of work actors are waiters and waitresses. So I figured similar thing. I'm a little bit bigger. I'm not huge, but yeah. 6'4", whatever. I'm going to be a bouncer. So I got on and luckily connected with a couple of guys and I got on, I guess you could call it a crew. And we were working at a place called Stringfellows and I'm not sure if it's still there anymore, but it was on 19th Street near Park Avenue. Very happening place, was always, I don't know, not always, but it used to be on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous a couple of times. And, mm-hmm. You know, I was like, this is great. I'm going to work at a place that is a pretty nice place. So things happen sometimes. I mean, usually the club was just fine. Everything was going on, you know. But occasionally you get a little drunk people and they start fights.
Sure. That's why you have a bouncer.
things came to things, if you want to put it bluntly, and got into a fight mm-hmm. outside of the club and got hit in the face. And so I hit back and that was all that person needed. So they were out on the ground and they were bleeding and kind of walked inside and I said, we got a little trouble because this guy started a fight outside and he's on the ground out there now. And anyway, the police came. So the police came and okay, fine. Well, before the police came, they can kind of see that he's been drinking, he's drunk and he had this smell on him. And I said, officer, I had to defend myself. He hit me first and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And nothing really came of it. But the thing that did come of it is I knocked out his tooth and severed a tendon in my index finger of my right hand.
Okay.
So I didn't really mean to say nothing came of it.
Yeah, yeah. But,
so, and the thing is, the adrenaline's flowing. I didn't even know I was bleeding. And one of the I don't know, waitress said, you're bleeding on your hand. Oh, okay. I looked down and I had a big deep gash and I had this white thing sticking out of my finger and I'm going, that looks like it could be a tendon. So I wrapped it up with a napkin and I said, I'm going to have to go to the hospital. So let me get this looked at and get it stitched up.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, back then I had no medical knowledge and I had nothing to, understand about all this stuff. So I go and I say, all right, doc, go to the emergency room at Cabrini Hospital. I think that was on like 21st Street or something, 19th Street or something like that, over there on the west side. No, east side of Park Avenue. And the doctor says, no, we can't sew that up. That's a bite wound. And it was approximately 1990. Yeah, this happens in 1990. So of course there is that air of like, oh, there's AIDS out there, there's HIV, all that stuff.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So of course I said, yeah, test me, please test me. And nobody really knew. Everybody was afraid of it, and I know now I'm not exactly afraid of it, but I can tell that it's still a disease that we want to get rid of. But
sure.
Back then, I was kind of shaking in my boots a little bit. Anyway, that all came out negative, but the wound in my finger could not be sewn up like in normal stitches because it was a bite wound. Okay, so now it was wrapped up, and after a few days, bite wounds get infected.
Oh yeah, that's the
human like 95%. Mouth is not a the human mouth is not a very clean place. So. Mm-hmm. It got infected. So I had to stay about a week in the hospital. Now, luckily, I'm telling you, luckily, this nightclub had insurance.
Okay.
So this was considered on the job injury. This is workman's compensation.
Yeah.
So I was, oh my gosh, I was thanking my lucky stars.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. So again, pushing forward, long story short, I had to stay for about a week. Okay, it was a tendon severing. I had to get IV antibiotics. The infection got all cleared up, but now my finger can't move and it's stuck. And I had to get surgery by a plastic surgeon to help reattach the tendon and do physical therapy. And while I was in the hospital, they were rounding, doing their rounds, daily rounds. So I'm in the hospital sitting there, and I see the doctor. He's discussing everything and talking to a whole bunch of other people. I said, oh, you guys nurses or something? And one of the young ladies said, no, we're PA students. What is a PA?
I still get that response.
Yeah. So that was my response back in 1990. What is a PA?
Sure.
Oh, this is like a really nice thing. Blah, blah, blah. She described what a PA does, and not a nurse. It's not a tech. It's a PA. It's a position that, you know, and she knew more about it than I had ever heard about it. So I said, I know this sounds kind of strange, but I do have a college degree, and I was wondering, could you give me the number to like inquire about it to see possibly maybe I could do this also as a living?
Yeah.
So from this pretty nasty bite wound, actually punch wound.
Yeah.
I found out about what a PA was. I applied to Bailey Seton Hospital PA program, which was in Staten Island, which is no longer there, by the way. I think the hospital is still there, but I think it's under a different name. But the PA program is no longer there.
Yeah, they're all master programs.
And
now.
I was accepted to the Bailey Seton PA program as on my merits alone. I didn't have to get any prerequisites or anything, and then I graduated with honors.
Wow.
So from something very bad happening came something very good. And at the time, again, same thing. My parents had no idea what a PA was. Can you get a job with that?
Yeah.
I mean, are you going to be able to get, I mean, that was the word. I said, it looks like it. Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't think you're going to have to worry about me anymore. Yeah. I'm not, you know, the acting was going to be put on hold, and I was going to be able to make a living and afford my own stuff. Because for a while there, I was just living on, you know, being a bouncer and doing some acting, and it was difficult to pay the rent.
Yeah, I imagine.
New York City, right. So anyway, there's that final story that I feel like the hand of God hit me and said, no, you shouldn't be doing this stuff, acting and bouncing. You should be helping people in the hospital. And here I am. I'm trying to help people in the hospital.
It's it comes in full circle. The episode just came in full circle because
Start
with PA and MPA. Well, that's I mean, and if you look at the butterfly effect, so things that happened way back then,
right?
And then of course I ended up talking to 20 years after. Let's see, 70, 90. Yeah, maybe it was around 2000, I don't know, 6 or 7. So 16 years later, I ended up talking to you about it, and then that's the route I went.
Yeah.
So yeah, those things work out.
We have this incredible website. Wait, what if?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's where this all comes from. Because the whole point of it is there's things that happen and you're like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I try to stay open-minded for everything. And things just tend to work out sometimes and we don't know why.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to talk about and fascinating to think about. And and then everyone's got a good story. And you're a perfect example of that. I mean, you're a friend of the family that we've hung out a bunch and never realized that you had these fun stories. But that's what,
you know more about me than most people now.
Yeah. Well, hey, guess what? This goes on Wait If podcast. This is a good one. So this one will probably go on in 2 weeks.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, appreciate no problem. It. I'll send you a link with when we have this up. Okay.
Very good. I would love to hear it, love to listen to it, and I don't know, maybe I'll spread the word.
All right. Appreciate it.
I'll tell people about your little blog site there. I think that's a great job. You're doing a great job.
Okay, thanks. You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWI Podcast and at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.